The change we need is not going to come easy. It's not going to come overnight. I mean, this administration has dug a deep hole for us.
The answer to a slowing economy is not higher taxes, but that's exactly what's going to happen when the Democrats have total control of Washington. We can't let that happen.
All right, fasten your seatbelts. 8 more days, and it will all be over. Or maybe it'll be 5 more weeks, like in Bush versus Gore, who knows. But the campaign end games are underway, and who knows what twists and turns we are still in for with a financial crisis maintaining its ability to shock, U.S. military action in Syria over the weekend, and Republican campaign officials sniping at each other over Sarah Palin's wardrobe. We are happy to have back with us now New York Times columnists Gail Collins and David Brooks. In addition to their columns, they've been keeping a running conversation with each other on nytimes.com about the campaign. Hi, Gail. Hi, David.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
And first of all, David, to see you on the NewsHour Friday, and for that matter, many other commentators on the weekend shows, it looks like those of you who really follow this super close believe it's over. Do you think McCain can't come back?
Well, I guess I believed it's over 9 months ago. So I've actually come to believe that tactics scarcely matter in this election or any election. One of the things I noticed during the primary season was that Obama and Clinton would go at each other with different tactics. But in the last 3 months of the primaries, nothing really changed. If you looked at the demographics of a state, you could pretty well predict who was going to win that state. And the tactics of the campaign didn't matter all that much. And when you look at the fundamentals of the general election, well, it's tough to win a White House 3 terms in a row. It's really tough when 80 or 90% disapproval in the way the country's going. It's pretty tough when the Democrats have opened up a 10-point registration advantage on the Republicans. The fundamentals are just all one way. And McCain can try this and that, but and he's certainly tried everything but the kitchen sink, but it's just really hard to do it with tactics.
Gail, do you feel the same way? I don't know any Obama supporters who are feeling easy and comfortable right around now.
No, I think that's, well, it's partly because they're Democrats. Something horrible always happens. And then partly because everybody really is worried there's a secret kind of race thing out there, although it's hard to imagine some, given the way people respond to questions like who can take care of the economy, who can do this, who can do that, it's hard to imagine. But, you know, David and I have talked about this in our conversations before. I think it's amazing to me that we spent the last 2 years talking about people's personalities and people's qualities and whether they're honest enough and whether they're decisive enough and all. It's all about the party. There's two parties, and when one of them screws up, people almost always put the other one in control. And the only things you can really predict about these people have to do with what parties they come from.
You don't think that's too simple? I mean, given all the complexities of, you know, trying to elect the first African-American president, if you're the Democrats, or John McCain with his weakness with his own base leading him to pick Sarah Palin, all that stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, I can't possibly say no. There is nothing else whatsoever except this, but that's the overriding story to me. It's interesting to me that we've created, and heavens knows I'm a card-carrying member of it, this entire body of people whose job it is in life to sort of analyze the personalities and characters of politicians. But over the last 2 years I've done it, the more I think it's just all about parties. And that's sort of the way it should be. You cannot really expect the poor average voter person to go in there and have come up with some kind of a Rorschach test about who's got the, I mean, after George Bush in particular, you can't really expect people to believe that what they think about a person's character at election time is going to carry through for 4 or 8 years.
Listeners, we can take some of your calls and comments for Gail Collins and David Brooks at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, about it not being issue-oriented, David, I think I read you wrote on your conversation blog with Gail that if Hillary Clinton had been the nominee, then this actually would have been a more issue-oriented campaign between her and McCain. Did you write that?
I did, mostly because I think Hillary and McCain like each other. They admire each other. They work for each other or worked with each other and travel together quite a lot. And so they have great admiration for each other. And I don't think you would have had the personal contempt that Obama and McCain feel for each other. And that's driven, actually, I hate to mention it, Gail, it's driven by character. They're totally opposite personalities. And from the moment Obama entered the Senate and the first time they had contact, they began to dislike each other. And I think I do disagree with Kale a little. As I said, I think the fundamentals really matter. But I do think character, especially in government, character matters. And voters are quite good at judging character because that's what we all do every day. And Obama could have screwed this up by being erratic or by doing something stupid or being untrustworthy or non-reassuring. He could have screwed up the fundamentals by having a different sort of personality than he has. And in office, I do think character is like 90% of it. Nobody would have thought that George Bush would have nationalized the banks. So the policies of the parties can be wildly unpredictable depending on the situation. But the way a president organizes decision-making and organizes the culture of his White House seems to me absolutely the most important thing he brings to the job, he or she.
How about that argument that we just heard on the news at the top of the hour from McCain about voting for him to balance a Democratic Congress, Gail? Is that too strategic for voters to get their minds around?
I think it is, although voters do, in general, like the idea that you have somebody checking somebody else. I've never known an election where we love to do that stuff, you know, send a message or do this, or only often in Albany we used to always say, well, only vote for whoever's out of power just because you have got to make these people behave better. But voters almost always go and just vote for the people that they like.
But
the best.
Is it a coincidence then that during our lifetimes we've had so much divided government, Democratic Congress during Reagan, Republican Congress once Clinton had been in for 2 years, David?
Well, I guess I agree with Gail. You rarely meet somebody who say, well, I love Obama, but we've got to have divided government, so I think I'll vote for that SOB McCain. I rarely meet anybody like that. But we've had divided government because we've had for a long time a reasonably closely divided country. And so it's not unusual. And I think if you look at the record of divided government, the record's just a lot better. If you look at government, it's just better when it's divided. That's not to say people are going to vote that way, but I think it's objectively true.
Gail, you agree with that?
No, I think in the New Deal, it was a really good thing that you had Democrats, you had a country in which you had both Congress and the president going the same way. And it's very possible we're in a situation that dire. I have no economic genius that allows me to know how we're going to pull out of where we are right now. But I do think it's going to be very bad, and it's going to go on for a long, long time. And it's going to involve the country kind of just rethinking the way people live and the expectations they have about what's going to happen during their lives. And at a time like that, it's really hard to imagine. It also is, you know, really true in particular of Congress. I've thought this for a long time, that if you've got a situation in which the other party thinks that they can get in if they just do one more smart thing, if everything is really divided and it's only a matter of one inch one way or the other when the other party takes control, that's the worst possible time, because then people just cannot do anything except strategize about how they're going to do the one smart thing and force the other party to vote for something that's going to make them look bad. And David has said this often, you never have actual votes where people are voting on the real thing that they're talking about. You only have votes about whether they're going to take this strategic position or embarrass their party or that kind of stuff, which is why you get all people like John McCain voting 90-odd% of the time with George Bush, because most of the votes really aren't on great issues of policy and consequence in times when the parties are closely divided. They're on little tiny weeny strategic ploys.
Let's take a phone call. Mike in Jackson Heights. You're on WNYC with Gail Collins and David Brooks. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hi, Brian, Gail, and David. I was just looking at Real Clear Politics, and I look at the election map, the way it's set up, you know, with few undecided states left and a few that seem to be leaning to Obama, maybe in a surprising way, Ohio, for example. But it just seems to me that if Ohio and North Carolina and Virginia, if they go to McCain, which still seems very, very reasonable, and all the up-in-the-air ones go to McCain, then McCain can still win this election, even though Obama might win significantly in popular vote. And I was curious to know what the columnist thought about that.
David?
Oh, well, I'm glad you're reading Real Clear Politics, one of my favorite sites, although they blacklinked me recently for apostasy.
what does blacklink mean?
Where they refuse to link. It's this is how you punish columnists.
Oh, okay, now I have to ask what your apostasy was.
Well, I haven't been good enough to the Republican Party recently.
The Sarah Palin column.
But anyway, it's an outstanding site and a great site for polls if you're interested in where the polls are. And I guess my view, if you go to the Real Clear breakdown of state by state, if you look at the swing states, the narrow red states like Virginia, North Carolina, Ohio, even Indiana, states like that, they're not blowouts for Obama, but he's ahead in every single one of them. And McCain would have to sweep the table to win. And the odds of the polls being off in every single one of those states, including Florida, is pretty slim, I would think.
Well, they have Indiana and Florida currently as a push.
A push, meaning about a toss-up? I guess we lost Mike.
Yeah.
Gail, do you want to agree with David or disagree with him at all?
I so frequently disagree with David that it's embarrassing, but I do agree with him on this. Unless the thing everybody is not knowing but thinking is not there, but maybe really is there, is some kind of underlying racial fear that's going to cause many, 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 many people to tell pollsters that they are going to vote for Obama or might vote for Obama, and they really aren't. But
right now, that would have to be so much bigger than the Bradley effect even was supposed to have been way back then, with Obama leading in the CBS New York Times poll last week by 30 points among Catholics, 20 points in the suburbs, all that stuff.
All that stuff. And you'd have to both take that and every single thing going McCain's way in every single other state, and a real change of direction at a time when people are filled every day with more fear and terror and more clarity that the people who are now in charge can't deal
with. But, Gail, fear and terror doesn't always work to the advantage of the Democrats, as you well know. And I read that. Let me play devil's advocate here for a minute, because I read that McCain is going to mount a final strategy that stays with Joe the Plumber and William Ayers indirectly, but also goes back to the issue of who'd be the best commander-in-chief. And lo and behold, the U.S. attacked militants in Syria over the weekend from Iraq, and the front page of the Times today reports an increasing number of U.S. attacks into Pakistan. Is this a coincidence?
Well, you'd have to ask David about that, since it's his administration.
It's yours now, David.
As you called, I was organizing an attack into Syria as we speak, and I'm now booting up for Pakistan myself. I think this one I have to take direct control over. This argument would be made. I can't believe it. I mean, if you think through every conspiracy theory of this sort, you have to think through the levels of chain of decision making and imagine everyone involved in that chain is decided, well, we're going to have a little raid into Syria because of the election. The idea that these professional officers would all take part in this without leaking it is, to me, bizarre. And it's totally understandable, by the way, as a policy measure, that next Anbar and in these areas we're searching down insurgents and we're launching these pinpoint raids into these places. The idea that it's an electoral tactic seems to me far-fetched.
Well, beyond that, though, if this becomes a problem, if Syria mounts, some counteroffensive against U.S. troops across the border into Iraq, or if it becomes an international source of outrage because the U.S. crossed the border, something like that, then could it not just, in the normal course of events, play to McCain's strength and fears of the Democrats to the extent that it could at least potentially be a game changer?
Brian, it would only be even conceivable if the thing that happened was so dire that people in America felt it was a direct threat to their safety. Right now, anything international has so fallen off the map of people's concerns that it would really have to be something that was all about us. I mean, the idea that somehow or another the strategy in the Middle East was being screwed up or changed is hardly makes even conversation for people anymore because they're so frightened about the economy.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnists Gail Collins and David Brooks. In addition to their columns in the paper, they've been keeping a running conversation with each other on a blog on nytimes.com about the campaign, and we're taking your calls. Our lines are full. By the way, next hour for our 30 Issues in 30 Days segment, we'll be talking about race, and not race in the campaign, race in America once one of these guys actually becomes president. And we have a comments page for that with the question, what specific topics should a national conversation about race include? So if you want to suggest something there, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Marcia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead, Marcia.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Marcia, go ahead. You have a question for Gail, I understand.
Well, I don't think it's not about personality. Two things. I've done a lot of campaigning, and I've been in communication with people, and I've been shocked, first of all, about the race issue, that people don't trust Obama. They think there's something sneaky about him. And I have family members who, down in South Carolina this last week, my ex-husband was with all these people, and they said that they think he's a plant. They truly, these are educated people. They think he's a plant. He's been groomed from birth to make it so that the blacks can take over America. And he was just astounded. These Duke-educated people, and it's...
It is, or you don't mean David Duke, right? No, I'm kidding. It is amazing, Gail, how much our political director, Andrea Bernstein, who's been going to swing counties around the country all fall, is able to find people with no compunctions willing to say racist things into her microphone.
It is. It's been a long time. What's interesting to me is that as a nation, we have come way before we came to a point of any kind of racial harmony, to a point where you understood it was wrong to say those things out loud, even if you harbored those kinds of racist thoughts. And partly this campaign has allowed them to come forward, just because somehow they now seem to be a matter of politics rather than personality. And, you know, when you asked before about why Democrats are so worried and why Democrats don't think they're going to win at this, because I swear to you, every single Democrat in America has at least one relative in Texas or North Carolina or
someplace
who is sending them emails explaining to them that Barack Obama is not actually an American citizen or that he's a Muslim or whatever.
Yeah, well, Nate Silver from the poll watching website 538.com had a different theory on this show. He said Democrats are like Cubs fans. They always think something's going to go wrong until it doesn't. But there you go. Jim at Jackson Heights for David. Hi, Jim. Jim, you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My question is basically for Mr. Brooks. You had mentioned that Obama and McCain didn't get along, and that before they ran for president. My question is, what was the specific incident that caused those problems? And what Republicans does Obama get along with? And will Obama learn any lessons from LBJ, Carter, and Clinton in the early days of Clinton when there was like one-party rule with just the Democrats?
Okay. David?
It's a good question. I've said a lot of nice things about Obama in my column and everywhere else. So what's about to follow is not going to be nice, but put in context. Obama was a mediocre senator, and senators regard each other by how many tough votes they take and how hard the work is. And I think it's very hard to find a Republican, maybe one or two I can think of, who has anything nice to say about Obama. And that came from, I think, primarily immigration reform, which was the one tough thing the Senate was undertaking while he was there and paying attention. And the charge, and this is the Washington Post had a big story on this, McCain and Kennedy were working on the immigration bill, and Obama was supposed to be taking part in the negotiations to get that bill put together. And the charges that he parachuted in tried to reopen issues that had already been settled by the people who were actually doing the negotiation, and then showed up at the press conference. And so reporters or senators on the Republican side have very warm feelings toward Hillary Clinton because she actually does the work and takes part in the negotiations. And they have very dour feelings about Obama because they think he's a show horse. And another Washington Post piece last Friday is worth looking at on the web on the strategic plan Obama created when he entered the Senate. And it was pretty clear from that plan he was not interested in the Senate, wanted to move up either to be governor of Illinois or to be president, and so used the Senate as a stepping stone. And I think that rubbed a lot of Republicans the wrong way.
You know, I think what David points out is really deeply true, that there are certain, and it doesn't bother me about Obama, I must say, particularly, there are people who like being senators, and there are people who see it as a stepping stone. John Kennedy was a good example of somebody who really didn't care about the legislative process and seems to be much more like Obama in his career track. Hillary Clinton really does like that stuff. And see, it's very possible that her natural perfect job in the world is being a U.S. senator. And you're right, people who are of the Senate just hate those other people who come in and have just contempt for it and just want to get out as soon as they can.
David, you've been very vocal about your disappointment with McCain never articulating a real governing philosophy in this campaign. You wrote it again yesterday. And yet you also wrote that you still think he'd make an outstanding president. Tell us how you can hold those two thoughts in your head at the same time.
Well, because he is not and to my frustration, I guess he's not a philosophical thinker who can argue a coherent philosophy. Nonetheless, having watched him in the Senate, I do think he has one instinctively, and he reacts to different issues on an issue-by-issue basis. And I think he genuinely reacts in quite a good way, say, on immigration reform, on campaign finance reform, on global warming, on the surge and things like that. And so his instinctive reactions strike me as the kind that would actually make a good White House. In the White House, you know, the president, Bush gets ridiculed for saying he was the decider. But in the White House, you know, every easy decision is taken away by the lower levels. And so every 5 minutes you're forced to make a decision based on your instincts and based on the worldview and the mental template you have of reality. And I think McCain has a pretty good mental template. And I think he works with people from the other party probably better than Obama will or could. And I also think he's proven that he'll take decisions that are against his political self-interest, which Obama hasn't.
We're almost out of time. We've just got about 2 minutes left with David Brooks and Gail Collins, New York Times columnists, and they keep a joint blog, a conversation about the campaign on nytimes.com. Will either of you announce in your column who you're actually voting for? Do you do that, Gail?
We don't do that. And it's a tradition that I don't know how far back it goes. When I was the editorial page editor, Hal Raines told me that was our tradition, and I bought into it.
It's not a rule.
Andy has too.
It's not a rule, but it's a tradition.
It's sort of a rule. It's kind of a rule, and it's not an intrusive rule, it seems to me. I think that the sense was you didn't want, say, David to say, go vote for John McCain, and then to see Ed saying, New York Times, : go vote for John McCain, when the editorial page actually endorsed somebody else. That's my sense of why we do it that way.
Could I add that, as a conservative, I think a tradition is better than a rule? And I've come to really value it, because one of the things, even as an opinion journalist, I think being aloof from the candidates is just tremendously, tremendously important. And so never publicly being for one or the other is just a nice barrier between you and the candidates.
Although I know
David said the wisest thing once again.
I know, David, though, a lot of people who, you know, between the two of you, let's say, since the two of you are the ones here, might say, well, with Gail Collins, you read her column, you can kind of figure out who she's going to vote for. With you, there's actually a mystery.
Yeah, and it would take me 20 minutes to dodge that question and answer that mystery, and I don't think we have time for that.
So that is where we leave it, with New York Times columnists Gail Collins and David Brooks. Thank you both very much.
A pleasure.
Thank you.